Welcome to It's Your World. This program features Walter Isaacson, president of the Aspen Institute and author of the recently published book, The Innovators. I'm Jane Wales, your host. So we're here with Walter Isaacson, the author most recently of a new book, The Innovators, and it's a history of the digital age and also of sort of how innovation happens. But I want to start with something very current, Walter, and that is that one of the characteristics of the digital age is that while it's created tremendous wealth, it's also exacerbated some disparities. And some of the folks you're writing about mm-hmm. are taking the lessons they've learned from their own innovations and applying it to social change and trying to right that wrong in their view.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about innovators of the digital age is they know it's all about inclusion, not exclusion. And so you look at Melinda and Bill Gates, what they're doing, and Melinda Gates especially on the role of women and in both tackling economic opportunity issues, but also, you know, just tackling all the problems of society. I know Laura Andreasen has been very active and with you. And so you see people who have been part of the digital revolution, realizing that our technological tools are only as good as we make them, and that we should use them and the wealth that's been created by this new technological boom to say, how do we make it a more inclusive, more equal society in which everybody has an opportunity? That can happen through the technology, as I'm hoping it will happen with K-12 education in America, where technology will give everybody a more equal shot at it. But we have to be on guard. I mean, if you look around, sometimes it exacerbates a digital divide between rich and poor.
And of course, Bill Gates has taken that lesson that collaboration across sectors works with things like Gain and Gavi, enterprises that combine the private sector and the philanthropic sector. Is this one of the lessons of the digital age?
Absolutely. If you go back to the very beginning of what I would call our modern digital age in the 1940s, there was a great collaboration that happened around this area in the Bay Area of California, but also around the country in Boston, New York, and other places, of a collaboration between government, which helped fund some of the great research of that time, universities, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, around the University of Pennsylvania, around the country, and then private enterprises. And I think we've lost that ability to have a not only cross-sector collaboration, but a collaboration between government, philanthropies, NGOs, corporations, and academia.
So as you let's sort of talk about innovation and how it happens and the nature of collaboration. When is collaboration an asset? What are the roles of teams on the one hand, and what's the role of the individual?
You know, we biographers sometimes feel we distort history because we make it seem like it's the individual, the guy or gal sitting in a garage or a garret. They have a light bulb moment and innovation happens. When I wrote about Steve Jobs, I marveled at what a brilliant individual he was as a visionary. But what was particularly impressive is he always found the right partner, starting with Steve Wozniak all the way through Tim Cook. And that ability to form teams is what made him so successful. When I asked him at one point what was the your product you're proudest of, I thought he'd say the iPod or the iPhone. And he said, you know, making a product is hard, but making a company where people can collaborate and create products one after the other, that's the main thing to do. So whether it's Mark Zuckerberg and how he's created Facebook, not just around one product, but as a team with Sheryl Sandberg, or the way the Google guys have done it with, you know, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, bringing in Eric Schmidt to create a team at Google, that ability to create a team and collaborate is the mark of successful visionaries, as opposed to some visionaries who have a great vision, but they can't execute. So it turns out to be pretty much just hallucination.
So, you know, we tend to celebrate the fact that now one can collaborate across geographies. But one of the points you make in the book is that collaboration is best when it's place-based. Say a word about that.
You and I know this from the Aspen Institute. You think you can do things through Skype or Google Hangouts, and you can do things across the world digitally. But every time we get together digitally, it sort of increases our desire to have some face-to-face meetings, some meetups, or to come convene, as you do, with the philanthropy group at the Aspen Institute. And I think whether it starts with, you know, Bell Labs, where you had corridors of people who were theoretical physicists, but also pole climbers who knew how to amplify a signal across the country, when they all got together in the hallways and they had serendipitous encounters, that physical convening, I think, is how you finish each other's sentences. You get inspired by other people. It's why Steve Jobs, when he created the Pixar headquarters, wanted one big atrium everybody had to walk through. It's why Marissa Mayer correctly said that you shouldn't try to telecommute every day. You should come in to Yahoo headquarters, because collaboration and creativity happen in person. That was her quote. And, you know, she knows digital tools, but that notion of collaborating in person, it's why we do meetings in Aspen, Washington, San Francisco for the Aspen Institute. But it's also why people who have met each other, you know, as Aristotle said, we're a social animal, met each other online, they tend to want to say, okay, let's get together and really brainstorm.
Yeah, we're basically social animals in the end. Talk to me about some of these centers of innovation, like Bell Labs, like IBM, like Xerox PARC. What were their characteristics? What made them work?
These were places where you could just do blue sky research. Bell Labs was interested in the most basic of all research. They have in the 1940s, for example, a group just looking at solid state switching so that you can replace vacuum tubes. And they end up creating the transistor. You look at Xerox PARC, which was placed in California so it'd be across the country from the main headquarters so they could just brainstorm and think. They come up with everything from the graphical user interface to Ethernet, precursors to everything we use today. Google has a lot of great basic research, and they pursue it. I do worry that in this day and age, we've cut back both at the corporate level and especially at the federal government level on basic research. And you look at the Ebola crisis, for example. I think of the sequester a couple of years ago, a year ago, the cutbacks in NIH funding. And I know all the people at Harvard, MIT, and the Broad Institute who were doing genetic sequencing to try to figure out exactly how viruses work. Well, that type of basic research, as Vannevar Bush, one of the heroes of my book, said in the 1940s, that becomes a seed corn for innovations and inventions in the future. So I worry about the fact that we've cut back the basic research and then an Ebola outbreak comes along and we say, gee, I wish we had been studying the basic fundamentals of genetic engineering and how it relates to viruses before this.
So this requires really thinking long term, though, both companies that are feeling pressed by the need for great quarterly reports, you know, and governments that are, well, they're dealing with the 24-hour news cycle, something you know well as a journalist.
Yeah, and you look at what Bell Labs did and Xerox did when they formed their research centers and, you know, IBM and other places. You do have to both think long term, and you're trying to create the basic fundamental level of research we need. And nowadays, neither in the corporate level nor at the federal level are there incentives for that. So you get great research universities like Stanford and Harvard and MIT and Penn and, you know, Columbia, Princeton, and they get cut back. Their grants get cut back. And so there are fewer and fewer people doing the basic research. I think that's a real critical need in our society, is to go back to understanding the importance. I mean, Eisenhower understood it. Eisenhower was the one who creates the Advanced Research Projects Agency at the Pentagon that, you know, does things like the ARPANET and then the Internet. But he also creates a space program. But he's not just doing it so he can have a specific product. He says, you know, these scientists, they're sowing the ground for the future.
Mm-hmm. And which is a reminder that those moments of national purpose, you see a lot of innovation. I'm thinking about World War II.
World War II is where certainly both in England at Bletchley Park, people like Alan Turing are creating computers to break the German codes. Even in Germany, you have Hermann Zuse doing computers to do it. And at Aberdeen Proving Ground, Harvard and Penn and MIT, you had these groups forming to do basic computer research. And they discover after a while, especially the women working on it, that you can reprogram these computers so it does other things besides ballistic missiles. And soon these computers become the backbone of a whole new economy. That national purpose that we had during World War II, you see replicated during the Eisenhower administration with infrastructure like the Interstate Highway Program, but also things like starting the space program, starting the internet and ARPANET. And President Obama has talked about doing what I think would be the great research project of this generation, which is mapping the human brain just like we map the human genome. But that was a lot of talk. And, of course, Congress never really appropriated any money for it.
Talk, but no budget. So World War II, as you've pointed out, it actually provided an opportunity for women when the men were on the front.
You know, it's totally amazing looking at the women during World War II who don't get their due in history much, partly because it was World War II and a lot of the work was kept secret, and partly because I think the men got more publicity when the computers were unveiled. But there was a group of about 70 women mathematicians who worked as computers, meaning human people who did computing, at the University of Pennsylvania and Aberdeen Proving Ground during World War II. And six of them in particular were pulled out to help take ENIAC, which was the big, colossal electronic computer that was being built. And it was being built to do missile trajectories, and they needed people to figure out how to program it and then unplug the cables and do the switches and replug them so they could be reprogrammed to do other problems. And getting back to education, one of the heroes of the book is a woman named Jean Jennings Bartik. I hope people will buy her. She died a few years ago, and after she died, she came out with a book called Pioneer Programmer. But she was somebody who was from Atlantis Grove, Missouri, a town of less than 200 people, from a big family that valued education. She goes off to study math at a Missouri State Teachers College, and it's, I think, $78 a year tuition. Now, and she becomes a great mathematician and does the programming for ENIAC when it's unveiled. And yet that college now costs $14,000. Yeah, yeah. When you start making it hard for people from average families, working class families, to go to a college like that and saddle them with debt, instead of saying this is grooming the next generation, I think you lose this possibility of including everybody in an innovative economy.
Well, what is great about, you know, one aspect of philanthropy that we all know about is giving to your alma mater. And sometimes that doesn't sound that interesting. But in fact, if you can bring that alma mater to the point that they can be needs blind, you know, and mm-hmm. bring in
I think
kids.
Every great university should aspire to be needs blind. And I'm not a creative philanthropist like the people at your philanthropy roundtable. So I do it pretty simple. I give to scholarship funds, you know, in any school I went to or any place I can. I just say, all right, I was just unbelievably lucky. I was a kid from Louisiana. My dad was an engineer, got a pretty good education, could, you know, afford it. And you say, all right, the one thing we all have to do is say, let's make sure everybody has that opportunity to get a good education. I know some of the philanthropists you work with are doing amazingly creative things. And obviously, from the Gates Foundation to family foundations that you deal with, they come up with innovative ways to work across sector and do philanthropy. As for me, I try to do what I can, but mainly just if there's a scholarship fund, let me donate to it.
And I think that some of them are trying to disrupt the current system. You talk about the characteristics of an innovator being a disruptor. Mm-hmm. I think you'd say that about John Doerr, who you know so well. The
venture
capital
John Doerr started, you know, helped start New Schools Fund, Venture Fund. And I look at what Kim Smith has done and created a whole Pahara Fellowship of people doing entrepreneurship and education. I look at Rocket Ship. John Danner had created things both as an Aspen Institute fellow, but he's been involved in our philanthropy as well as our education programs. I look at Sal Khan, who the Doors have also funded, and Doerr in particular, and I say, okay, they're creating a blend of technology and schoolroom that eventually we're going to crack the code and say, how do we make it so it works? I once wrote a book about Benjamin Franklin. He created the Academy for the Education of Youth in Philadelphia. If he walked into most schoolrooms today, he'd say, yeah, that's what we had. We had 20 desks in a row and a teacher up front giving a lecture on a blackboard. And I think finally, after all these years, after 250 years or so, we're seeing great philanthropists helping reinvent education and using technology and philanthropy together.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Sal Khan and Khan Academy. My understanding is that Aspen Institute will be partnering with Khan Academy on some...
Yeah, if you go to Khan Academy and you look at the American history and American civics, you'll see that we produce that at the Aspen Institute because we have a lot of people who come to the Institute, you know, Supreme Court justices and professors and great historians. So ranging, you know, from... John Ellis, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Lynn Cheney, but also Sandra Day O'Connor and some of the Supreme Court justices were looking about how our civic life developed. And I think it's just a way to use that to help expand what Khan Academy does so well in math and science and say, let's do civics as well.
So taking back, though, to those moments of national purpose, I think we do have that moment of national purpose around education right now, and the current administration very, very focused on this, and you personally have been very focused on this. There was another moment of national mobilization, and that was the space race, right? And you did mention that Eisenhower helped mobilize resources and public attention around it. Talk about its role in the digital age.
Sure. I mean, Eisenhower decides to start a space agency, and then Kennedy, right when he comes into office, says we'll send a man to the moon and return him by the end of the decade. You know, that just spurs a lot of things. For example, the transistor had been invented, but you had to have a guidance system and a computer in the nose cone of a rocket. So that spurs the invention of microchips. It makes microchips, which Intel, Texas Instruments, and others were creating, into something that they know that there's a huge market for. It also helps spur the development of computers. And so that ability to say we have a national purpose here ends up throwing off enormous benefits.
Yeah, and that's where Gordon Moore comes into your story at that moment.
Of course. Gordon Moore, who I had the chance for this book to spend a lot of time with, you know, he comes up with the notion when he's at Fairchild Semiconductor and then Intel that the processing power of a microchip will double every 18 months or so. And that helps give a roadmap to the development of everything from the personal computer to our cell phones. We know which way computers are heading, and it's held pretty much true. But one of the things about Fairchild Semiconductor, which Bob Noyce, Andy Grove does it when they form Intel, and Gordon Moore do, is they know they have a market for it because our government is funding a lot of really cool things, the space race being one of them, but even military things like Minuteman missiles needed it. I'm not hoping for a lot more wartime spending, but I am hoping for government to have a specific purpose and say we can rebuild America's infrastructure, we can reinvigorate America's schools, we can map the human brain just like we did the human genome, and we can do new forms of connecting our technology to bioengineering.
Now, one of the fun things about your book, and frankly, every one of your books, all of which I've read with great pleasure, is that you have these little nuggets. For example, that when folks like Gordon Moore and others left Fairchild Semiconductor, they were referred to as the Fair Children.
That's right. Well, one of the first interesting things is when they leave Shockley Semiconductor, because William Shockley had helped create the computer at Bell Labs. Bell Labs was a very collaborative place. Everybody there liked giving credit more than taking credit, except for Bill Shockley. He was a little bit paranoid. He became racist as he got older, but he was very much of a glory hog and resented the fact that other people were getting credit. When he creates Shockley Semiconductor in the Bay Area here, he becomes very difficult to work with. And eventually, Bob Noyce, Gordon Moore, and others spin off from Shockley Semiconductor, and they form Fairchild. And then eventually, because they don't want to be a division of a hierarchical, authoritarian East Coast company, they form their own company, which they call Intel, and it becomes a very non-hierarchical company with just a big old open workspace and everybody being able to share peer-to-peer, which is sort of ingrained in the genetic code of how we do things in the digital age.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things you say about Silicon Valley is that the digital age is not only did folks innovate around technology and around its use, but they also innovated when it came to corporate culture, to management.
Absolutely. You look at one of the great inventions of our time, and it was Intel and Atari forming this sort of laid-back, non-hierarchical corporate culture in which everybody had a right to share ideas. You didn't have to go through a chain of command. Also, around that time when Fairchild is becoming Intel, you have Arthur Rock and people who've come from the East Coast, and they form the concept of venture capital where people take risks. And they even bet on people who have failed before. We're one of the few places on Earth where, you know, failure is not an option. It's a line on your resume. And failure is an option. Right. It's a line on your resume.
As long as you're learning from it, it's very much.
Right, right. But it's also, if you're afraid of failing, you're never really going to be a great innovator. And that's what the whole systems we have now of startup companies, entrepreneurs, venture capital, non-hierarchical workplaces, places like Google that not only produce their products, but envision all sorts of products from driverless cars to Google Glass that are great.
Yeah. So let's talk about the characteristics of an innovator, the sort of personality traits. Risk-taking is one of them, as you know. Yeah. But what are the other ones?
You know, I think the ability to connect the humanities to technology. A lot of people talk about artificial intelligence and the singularity is about to come take over our lives. Maybe so, but that always seems 20 years away. In fact, since the early 1950s, people saying it's 20 years away, it's 20 years away. In the meantime, as J.C.R. Licklider said in the 60s when he was talking about artificial intelligence, he said, how do we make our machines more intimately connected to us? So if you look at the history of the digital age, it's people who had a feel for humanities and for humans and how to make those human connections to machines more personal, more intimate. That's why we got away from the big hulking computers to the personal computer. That's why Steve Jobs said, let's put 1,000 songs in your pocket. Or the people at Texas Instruments decided, hey, we've gotten the transistor and we manufacture it. Let's create the transistor radio so radios can become more personal. And now, whether it's Apple Watch or Google Glass, that ability of a computer actually to hold our hand and touch our wrists and look us in the eye, that to me is more important than the pursuit of artificial intelligence.
And it's interesting that, you know, I mean, as most folks who've taken a look at this book know, you open it with Lord Byron's daughter, and
Ada
Lovelace, and you say that she got the connection between the humanities and technology. In her case, it was between poetry and mathematics. But
exactly.
Say something about that.
You know, and I use her as a symbolic character. She opens and closes the book. She's Lord Byron's daughter, so she's has an appreciation for poetry. Her mother, Lady Byron, was not particularly fond of Lord Byron when Ada was growing up and had her tutored mainly in mathematics. But Ada develops what she calls poetical science. You can read wonderful books about her, Betty Toole, Dorothy Stein. Many people have written great books about Ada Lovelace, and they all stress the fact that she understood poetry, but she applied it to machines and technology. Her father was a Luddite, seriously. I mean, he defended the followers of Ned Ludd, who was smashing the mechanical looms that were using punch cards in the early 1800s in England to weave tapestries. But Ada loved the way those punch cards instructed the looms to weave patterns. And when her friend Charles Babbage was creating a calculating machine called the analytical engine that did numbers, and it was using punch cards, she said, those punch cards can make it do more than just numbers. It can do anything that can be notated symbolically, such as music. It can compose music. It can make beautiful patterns and art. It can process words. And that's the notion of a general computer that comes from connecting this feel for beauty, art, and the humanities to technology and engineering and science.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, making technology personal. So back to the attributes. One of the attributes of innovators, certainly in the digital age, has been a kind of resistance to authority. Say something
about
that. Especially
when it comes to the personal computer, because You know, in the early days of the computer, they were considered rather Orwellian. They were going to be run by the Pentagon or the power structure or the elite or the corporate America, the government. And then, especially in the Bay Area of California, you have a mixture of a whole bunch of tribes, ranging from people who are in the anti-war movement, community organizers who were trying to organize, you know, sort of neighborhood schools and community centers. You had the hippies who were doing the electric Kool-Aid acid test, and electronics geeks and wireheads and phone freakers and, you know, people who worked, you know, for the electronics company. And they have one particular thing in common, which is they tend to resist authority. They tend to think that, as Stuart Brand said when he did the Whole Earth Catalog and he was at the epicenter of these tribes in the Bay Area, it's, we want access to tools. We want hands-on access to tools. And that's something that the hackers and the community organizers and the Whole Earth communalists could all agree on. And so that notion of taking computing power and bringing it to the personal computer became sort of a mantra of the Homebrew Computer Club, which is where Apple is germinated by Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs. But also when Bill Gates creates BASIC for the first hobbyist computer, the Altair, it gets shared by members of the Homebrew Computer Club. And that sort of sharing peer-to-peer mentality, that resistance to corporate authority, I think is embedded in how the internet was designed and the personal computer.
So Bill Gates wasn't really a part of that culture in the sense that he was not happy when the BASIC technology was shared.
No,
say something about that.
When his BASIC for the Altair was shared, he wrote a letter to the members of the Homebrew Computer Club, outraged and saying, you know, you've got to pay for software. But in the end, the fact that everybody shared BASIC made BASIC the standard yep. you had to use, and it actually made Bill Gates understand, hey, we got to create the industry standard. So when it came time to do an operating system, he doesn't sell it to IBM. He just lets them have a license mm-hmm. to it. I do think that you have a tension, which is a healthy one, that grows up, and Bill Gates is part of it. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak represent that tension as well, between those who are part of the anti-authoritarian, peer-to-peer sharing, open source field, and those who want to, you know, monetize it, make money off of it. For example, when they show off the computer at the Homebrew Computer Club and they look at the Intel microprocessor, Steve Wozniak says, oh, I can use that microprocessor, and he makes a circuit design for a great hobbyist computer, and he hands out for free the specs of that computer, members of the Homebrew Club, and Steve Jobs, his friend from down the street who's with him, says, wait a minute, we can go to my parents' garage and we can manufacture these things and we can sell them. Thus, you have the birth of Apple. And ever since then, you've had a tension between proprietary systems, as Apple's operating systems tend to be, and open systems, the way GNU Linux or, to some extent, Android is. And that tension between shared open systems and proprietary systems, I think, helps spur innovation.
Yeah. And say something more about Linux and the role that it played.
Yeah. I think it was very important that people like, you know, Richard Stallman and others felt it was important to have an open system that was not only free, but it was open and it was done collaboratively and shared. And then Linus Torvald creates a kernel for it called GNU. So you have a GNU Linux operating system that in many ways helps temper what could be a dominance of a particular industry. I also think you can look at Wikipedia, for example. We all share, we all edit on Wikipedia. I hope Bitcoin helps create an economy that allows for more sharing and peer-to-peer collaboration. Because you do want to have people make a buck or two every now and then. They got to pay the mortgage, they got to, you know, pay to raise their kids. So you want to have an economy that allows both sharing and open source, but also allows some way for people to say, and if you feel like giving a tip or a Bitcoin or helping to pay for this, that's a good idea. I love the way we have these parallel economies growing yeah. up.
You're listening to It's Your World. This program features Walter Isaacson, president of the Aspen Institute and author of the recently published book, The Innovators. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Now, as you make very clear throughout the book, this all takes teams, but there are also some individuals who stand out. And one of them, Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web 25 years ago.
25 years ago. We're about to celebrate the big anniversary.
It's the big birthday. That's someone who said, you know, he was a lone inventor, if I understand correctly.
Right. More but
he
than also most said, people, yeah.
He also said, don't patent this. Make this. Give this to the public domain.
Well, he was more than most people in the digital age, a singular inventor. He's sitting there at CERN, the Atom Smasher in Switzerland, and he has to make sure people there can collaborate. People who speak different languages can share research. For that matter, computers that speak different language can share things. So he comes up with a set of protocols that allow a hypertext transfer and markup language that rides on top of the internet. And it's there built for collaboration, even though he needed a partner. Kalu, a great Belgian engineer, is sort of his bird dog who helps get it through the bureaucracy at CERN. And then it becomes a very collaborative effort to let the web spread. Mark Andreessen, we've just talked about his wife. He's just a corn-fed, big old hulking student at the University of Illinois, and he creates Mosaic, which is a browser that allows ordinary folks to just download it, use it easily, get on the web. It's a creation of Mosaic, I think, in late 93, early 94, that allows the web, which had about 700 websites at the beginning of 94, to have 10,000 at the end of 1994. So even products that have one particular visionary, they end up being built collaboratively. And just as I said earlier on, that vision without execution is hallucination. Execution without a great visionary is barren. And so it takes visionaries like Mark Andreessen, Tim Berners-Lee, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, others, Gordon Moore and Bob Noyce, to make it so that a collaborative team is creative, imaginative.
You think about Mark Andreessen and what he did, and Bill Gates, what he did. They were 19-year-olds when they made these contributions.
I remember I was at Time Magazine. We put him on the cover, and he was barefoot. but it is true that I think this sort of notion of being able to risk things. I mean, Bill Gates drops out of Harvard and goes to Albuquerque, where they're assembling the Altair, so he can write BASIC for it. And Mark Andreessen just sits there and looks at the web, and he's stunned by it. And as a graduate student, he and two or three other people work together and form a web browser. Obviously, Mark does it in his dorm room at the University of Illinois. Larry Page and Sergey Brin do it as graduate students at Stanford. And I think there's an exuberance, just a passion. A lot of them make money doing it, but I don't think they were driven initially by the money. They were driven initially by the exuberance and the passion of saying, let's work together with people and create something cool and new. Mm-hmm. Google's the best example because Google looks like it's some computer thing that searches the web, but what it actually does is it aggregates all the human judgments people make each day when they put links on their websites. And so it's sort of, as Ada Lovelace would appreciate, the ultimate connection of technology with human imagination and judgment.
And before Larry Page and Sergey Brin, there were two other Stanford students, Jerry Yang and
David Filo.
But what I love, I learned in your book.
And by the way, you notice they all come in partnerships usually.
That's
whether
right.
Whether it's Woz and Steve Jobs or Bill Gates and Paul Allen or the Filo and
Jerry Yang.
Jerry and Yang and obviously Sergey and Larry. And I think one of the cool things, it's like the Lennon-McCartney concept, Joshua Wolfshank writes about that, of having somebody you can bounce ideas off of is awesomely important.
And
it was Robert Kailiw, I forgot to give his first name, who was sort of a partner of Tim Berners-Lee at CERN.
And what's interesting is that they meet each other and form a bond at a relatively young age. I mean, it's not to say it can't happen later.
I love the story of Larry and Sergey. I think Larry is admitted to Stanford as a graduate student. He has an orientation program where he meets Sergey, who's one of the guides, a year ahead of him at Stanford Graduate School, just in San Francisco. And they spend the entire day arguing with each other, then finishing each other's sentences, and then deciding to make a dent in the universe.
Right. And friends for life, as well as colleagues for life.
Yeah, occasionally you have the fallings out. But, you know, for example, if you look at Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, they were, you know, very different. And it truly is Jobs who builds the company. And Woz gets left behind a little bit. But I remember the very last product launch I went to, you know, that was Steve Jobs' last product launch. There was Woz in the waiting room, in the audience, and getting a shout out from Steve. And likewise, Bill Gates really was the visionary and driving force, not Paul Allen, you know, not Steve Ballmer. And so sometimes there's a bit of tension there, but I do think that you find that a Bill Gates really, really knows how to partner with people. And, you know, people have to get used to the fact that whether it's a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or whatever, even in a partnership, there's often a driving force, and they deserve to be given free rein. I mean, you and I have never created Apple or Microsoft, and so you got to give these guys credit, even if they were, you know, a bit aggressive.
There are dominant figures. There are in this. I mean, what's interesting is that one of the things we often think about out here in the Bay Area is the sort of founder's mindset, mm-hmm. that kind of dogged determination that can be irritating, right? If you're not on board,
right? But. And you know, those of us who want to criticize the founder's mindset of being aggressive, you have to look at the fact, did they create great teams? And of course, Steve Jobs did create an awesomely loyal team around him. And sometimes people say, well, I wish you were nicer, but Wozniak told me, you know, if I were running Apple, I think I would have been nicer. I would have made it much more like a family. And then he paused for a second. He said, but if I were running Apple, we wouldn't have really created the Macintosh or the iPod. So it takes a certain mentality to inspire loyalty, the way Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, others do, but also be aggressive enough to break a little bit of China now and then.
There's a little bit of the sort of naughty boy culture in all this, too, though. I mean, when you think about Wozniak and Jobs, their early kind of escapade to kind of let us use the phone for free kind of
the
thing.
The phone freak thing. Well, as I said, you have to be a bit of a rebel. You have to have a bit of an anti-authoritarian streak to disrupt, to question things. And, yeah, I think they were all a bit rebellious. A lot of them drop out of school. A lot of them get in trouble. But that rebel streak allows you to think different. I mean, I go back, I wrote about Einstein. He runs away from school, too, the German school system. It's too rigorous. He's a rebel. He thinks different. And it helps him because everybody else in that period who was doing physics had read the first paragraph of Newton's Principia that tells you time marches along, you know, irrespective of how we observe it. And there's Einstein trying to figure out, could I catch up with a light wave? And he says, well, how do we know time is absolute? Maybe time is relative, depending on our state of motion. Those type of abilities to think out of the box, or as Steve Jobs would say, to think different, that comes with the rebel, anti-authoritarian, questioning authority mindset that we're pretty good at nurturing in America, and I hope we remain so.
And it's also a bit of a, politically, a bit of a libertarian streak. I mean, you'll see that in Peter Thiel or Elon Musk, who created PayPal. There's a sort of sense that government should be held at bay.
Yes, I'm not sure I agree with that totally. I do think that we have to recognize you wouldn't have the computer, the transistor, or the internet without a collaboration with government. And I also think that even with that libertarian mindset, you also see a collaborative way of thinking, but also with all the people you mentioned, a realization that we want to make society better. We want to help things. We want to help people. We want to make sure society is more inclusive. So even if you may rankle at some of the things the government does, you realize you've been lucky, and I'm going to try to make our education system better or our equal economic opportunities for all. And I think Tocqueville kind of misunderstood that, not that I should ever knock Tocqueville, but he said that America's individualistic streak was fundamentally at odds with its streak of forming community and forming association. But there's something odd about the American character, starting with quilting bees and barn raisings back in colonial days, in which we were highly individualistic, and yet we liked to work together, form voluntary associations the way Ben Franklin did, the way so many people did, so that by forming associations, we could make a nation and communities that were stronger for everybody.
In many ways, you're describing what the Aspen Institute is about. I can't help but think about that. I mean, it brings together extraordinary leaders, but it's all about the notion of coming together in a neutral form and solving large problems together.
I think people like solving problems, and you're very involved with the work we're doing to look at poverty, economic inequality, economic opportunity issues. I do think when we look at our society and we want to say, we got to make sure every kid has an equal opportunity to get a really good education. Well, that's not a partisan issue, and that's not just a big government issue. That demands trying to figure out the Common Core and how the Common Core allows us to innovate. It allows Sal Khan to create a one-room schoolhouse to have core standards. But also, we have to figure out where core standards, you know, not working so well. How do we improve teachers? How do we give teachers tools? These are the type of things that if people of goodwill sit around and try to hash out most of our problems in our society, 80% of us could agree on approximately 80% of the solution. Mm-hmm. There's more common ground, and yet our institutions of government and media tend to divide us rather than unite us. I hope the Aspen Institute is just one of many places that say, actually, how can we get together and have a solutions-based discussion on some of the issues we all agree that we should tackle.
Yeah, and get away from the notion that compromise and capitulation are the same thing.
You know, Benjamin Franklin, Continental Congress when they did the Declaration of Independence, and then when they write the Constitution at the Constitutional Convention, he kept stressing a particular point when he came up with sort of solutions and compromises. It was that compromisers may not make great heroes, but they do make great democracies. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important to be able to say, here's the common ground we can find.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let me just take you to some of the policy issues that relate back to the digital age. One of them, I think about immigration. You think about the talent that ended up in Silicon Valley, from the Andy Groves to the Peter Thiels to the Elon Musk to the Sergey Brin. I mean, it's a very long list.
Right.
These are job creators. But we often think of immigration as the source of loss of jobs.
You know, I think we make two fundamental mistakes, and Lord Byron, is the beginning of it. One is that technology destroys jobs rather than creates a more productive economy, which of course means more jobs. And secondly, that immigration takes jobs away from people. I think that if you create a more inclusive society, if you look at, as you said, everybody from Andy Grove to Sergey Brin, you will say America has got to remain a land of opportunity, a magnet for great talent from around the world, and an inclusive society. I mean, I grew up in New Orleans. I still go back there all the time. And I try to figure out, there's a certain creativity in New Orleans, whether it's jazz or food or whatever. What causes that creativity? Well, it's the diversity of the communities in New Orleans that are always being replenished with, immigrants, but new waves of creative people. And so I think when we become insular and closed and exclusive, we forget the fundamental creed of America, which is twofold. One is every kid deserves a decent opportunity. And number two, we're all in this together.
Yeah, yeah.
We share a national creed.
Yeah. Now, on the job creation side, there's a real understanding that seeding small and growing businesses really can make a huge difference. I mean, that mm-hmm. allows people to kind of enter the world in commerce, become entrepreneurs. I think of innovations like eBay. For example, Pierre Omidyar, the original founder of eBay, as being actually a tool for precisely that, for lowering the barriers to trade, to enterprise.
Sure. Once you have eBay coming along, you have a whole maker's economy that allows people to create things and sell them. I think if you look at anything from, you know, Uber to a lot of what we're doing now, these are type of things we didn't know would exist. As I said, I hope we do have an internet economy that allows some easy digital transactions so people can make songs or make movies or make games and get easily compensated for it. I remember when Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone, initially he was against having third-party apps being developed for the iPhone because, you know, he was very proud of his creation, didn't want other people to pollute it with junky stuff. But eventually, because Steve could be a tough person, but he always knew how to listen and change his mind when need be, his board and others convince him, including John Doerr, let's have independent third-party apps. That creates, I think, in the very beginning almost, a $2 billion within 1 year economy of people creating apps. And those apps each do something, like, you know, help you share medical records, help you form communities, whatever, help you, you know, disrupt the taxi cab industry, whatever it may be. So I think we always have to look at both immigration and technology as providing infusions of new ideas and fresh thinking. And that, in the end, I hope will increase our productivity and our economy. I mean, throughout this book, throughout human history, there have been people who've resisted technology because they say it will destroy jobs. That's never happened. If you look at the data, if you look at the historical points, in the end, technology opens up new opportunities. People say, well, this time it may be different. Maybe so. Maybe this time it is a bit different. But we keep getting surprised by the tools, including new tools for education, new tools for healthcare that the digital innovations provide. So I suspect this time isn't all that different from the history of every other time, where whether it's the Industrial Revolution or the Scientific Revolution, the digital revolution will help bring us to a more productive economy.
So these are new jobs, but they're different jobs. So it strikes me that, it back to the issue of education. How do
Absolutely.
You gain
you
entry?
You need to do two things. You need to create an education system that fosters imagination, flexible thinking, and creative thinking. Because who knows where the next jobs will be, and you can't just say, let's just train people to do the exact jobs we have now. You have to train people to think, to question, to be curious, to be imaginative. And secondly, I think, you know, when I was growing up, we had the best kindergarten through 12th grade education system in the world, number one, however you measured it, graduation rates, college rates, test scores in math and reading and everything else. Now we're somewhere between, you know, 17 and 25. And if we're going to be the 17th best education system in the world, we'll eventually be the 17th, you know, most productive economy instead of the most productive economy. I don't see that happening yet, but we got to make sure that we're allowing a Gene Jennings to go to a state college and become a great mathematician, that we're, you know, making sure that there's equal access to educational opportunities for everybody.
And, of course, you seem to be arguing for both a liberal education, so it teaches you how to learn, right? Learning how to learn, in essence, but also things like these coding boot camps that may teach you how to learn in teams.
Yeah, I mean, one of the secrets of everybody from Ada Lovelace to Steve Jobs, as we said at the beginning, is this ability to connect the liberal arts humanities side of our lives with engineering, technology, and science. I do think sometimes if you focus too much on STEM education, you forget that it's the humanities that teach us to be imaginative, creative, and it will be the creative industries that I think are part of the next wave of the digital revolution. But there is a flip side, which is every now and then people will be extolling the humanities and the arts and saying we need to do more of that. And you say, of course, that's right. But you love the arts. You'd be appalled if one of your friends bragged that they didn't know the difference between Hamlet and Macbeth. But you go around, I'm picturing a fictional person here, you know, sort of boasting that you don't know the difference between an integral and a differential equation or a transistor and a capacitor or a gene and a chromosome. So those who grew up in the tradition of the arts and the humanities should, like Ada Lovelace did, like Steve Jobs did, say yes, but math is kind of beautiful, too. And engineering and technology can be very interesting. It's why I wrote this book, which is you want to see the beauty of the people who say, I got a piece of silicon. I can turn it into a semiconductor that'll be an on-off switch, and I understand how an on-off switch can help us do logic on a circuit board. Those things are, you might say they're difficult, but they're certainly not more difficult than Hamlet, and yet we all try to appreciate, you know, we all love Hamlet, and we all wrestle with, did Hamlet love Ophelia? So those of us who love the arts and the humanities also should try to read up and bone up on those who are pretty cool in science and math.
So I'm going to take you to another policy yeah. debate, but let me just say that one of the things that Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, and you have in common is this ability to talk about technology in terms that non-technologists can understand. What's marvelous about this book is it is so easy to grasp complex notions of engineering and technology. So it's a striking fact about the book.
Well, thank you. I mean, my dad was an engineer. I loved soldering circuits when making ham radios and Heathkits when I was a kid. And I think, you know, just as Ada Lovelace could look at one of her father's lines, like, you know, she walks in beauty, you know, like the night, or another poetic image like rosy-fingered dawn, and picture it, she was also able to picture what a mathematical equation did, to visualize things. And I actually have always loved, I mean, if you look at Einstein's theories, they're very visual. He did them as visual thought experiments. He imagined what would it be like to ride alongside a light beam? Would the waves seem stationary to me? And then he visualized what would it be like on a fast-moving train if lightning struck both ends? How would different people see the lightning strike? Or that the universe was the gravity curved space and time. These are truly beautiful things. And I try in my book, even if it's the transistor or the internet or internet protocol or a hypertext transfer protocol, these are things we all write, HTTP occasionally. But if you actually visualize how they work, I think you're less detached from your technology. There's some alienation that occurs when you think that the web is magic instead of a real person who was, you know, just a normal guy, Tim Berners-Lee, actually worked with ideas of Ted Nelson and other people and figured out how does this work. Then you're not as alienated from the technology. You're more comfortable with it.
So let me take you to a policy issue that's really seized Silicon Valley and Washington and others at the same time. And that is the trade-off between security and privacy that is perceived. And you know, now we've got Apple and Google soon to come out with products that can evade or frustrate any effort by the government to gain metadata on your communications. Talk about that tension and where you think we'll come down.
You know, I think it's wonderful to have the tension. It's a dialectic. And the important thing throughout the history of innovation, whether it's, you know, the looms putting people out of work, according to Lord Byron, or, you know, Plato and Aristotle talking about writing on, you know, and whether that will destroy rhetoric, is can our moral sensibilities, our social sensibilities, keep up with our technology? It happens usually. Almost every time we're able to keep up with it. You can maybe point to a few major problems where we've, you know, not kept up with our technology, the atom bomb being one of them. But nowadays, you see a wrestling over communications technology and how much anonymity is good, how much privacy is good. Privacy and anonymity aren't quite the same thing, although people sometimes confuse the two. And we went too far, definitely went too far, with the eavesdropping that the NSA and others did. I watched a segment and actually talked to at one of our forums, people like Michael Hayden, but also the great reporter James Risen. It's amazing how much common ground they actually have. Where Michael Hayden said, you know, I'm not sure we should have, you know, our NSA, he was in the intelligence community, that we should have exposed all of this because we needed it to fight terrorism. But I agree. We're there defending the Constitution, so we shouldn't start putting people in jail. And it's good that the conversation occurred. So I know it's a balance. I don't know exactly where the balance is, but the people who believe that we should have total anonymity in everything we do, we've never had that throughout history. I didn't have that growing up in New Orleans. If I walked to the drugstore on the corner and bought a pack of Marlboro, it would be back in my parents. You know, they'd know it in 12 minutes. But then again, we do want privacy because privacy is integral to imagination, creativity, expression, the free flow of thinking. So I watch it, how we're wrestling with balancing it. And instead of being appalled, I'm somewhat impressed with, especially in this country, how we can have such a debate and make mistakes. But then the mistakes are all over the front pages of the newspaper that we made this mistake. And suddenly we're trying to rectify it. I don't think we've rectified it yet. I don't think we've hit the balance yet. But I do think whenever we do something wrong, instead of it spiraling out of control, there's a balancing mechanism where things become public. A reporter puts things on the front page of the papers and people get mad that she or he did so. But still, it's good for the public discourse. So I'm pretty optimistic about our ability as a human species and our ability as a nation to debate this, hash it out, and strike the balance between being able to communicate with total anonymity and having a system in which courts and the government can sometimes find a way to say, based on a court order, these things happen. We haven't gotten there yet, and we certainly messed up doing it legally at first. But I suspect we'll get to the right place.
So I'm just going to end with one sort of fun fact that's in your book. And I have to say, it's throughout, it's sprinkled to these fun facts. Tell us, what are the origins of the phrase debugging? Get the bugs out.
Well, you know, we've ever since Edison and before, people have talked about a bug, being a problem. But Grace Hopper, who is one of the great programmers and helps create COBOL, but she's leading a team that's programming the Mark I and the Mark II at Harvard, which is the first big old electromechanical computer. It's got a few switches and electromechanical relays, and one day it isn't working, and something's wrong with it, and they can't figure it out. And finally, they open up, and they're looking, and there's a moth caught in one of the electromechanical relay switches. And they take the moth out, and they actually take a piece of tape, and they tape it into their logbook, and they say, we found a bug in the machine, we debugged the machine. And ever since then, that's popularized the notion of bugs in a machine. And I'm glad you pointed out, because the digital age is filled with wonderful tales and smart, funny people doing cool things. And as I said, I think we'll be a little bit less alienated from our technology, a little bit less worried about eavesdropping and snooping, if we understand how cool and fun and funny the hackers and geeks and geniuses and innovators and entrepreneurs who created this revolution were, just like we try to understand how cool the people who created the American Revolution or the Industrial Revolution or the Scientific Revolution were.
Walter Isaacson, thank you so much, both for this book and this conversation.
Jane, it's so wonderful being with you, and thank you for all you do at the Aspen Institute.
You've been listening to It's Your World. This program featured Walter Isaacson, president of the Aspen Institute and author of the recently published book, The Innovators. Our recording engineer is Howard Gelman. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. It's Your World is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.